We're going to finish up now Mitzvah Reish Zayin, the prohibition of Nida, and it's two paragraphs from the end, V'inyan, in my edition at least, V'inyan Tvilasan, that the Nida status is only removed by immersion in the mikvah, and you continue to be Chayiv Kares, even if the woman is not menstruating, even if she's past 7 days or seven clean days or whatever, Idaraisa, Derabanan, you're at. If she hasn't gone to the mikvah yet after the minimum designated time, she's still subject to the prohibition of Kares, both for her and the person who has relations with her. Sheitzrichu osan chachamim litbol balayla, that the sages required her to immerse in the mikvah at nighttime. So what do you mean the sages required her to immerse at nighttime? We're talking about a nida de araisa, that a woman's tummy for 7 days, and no matter how long she sees blood, and it's a 7 full days. So obviously she has to go to the mikvah. The earliest time she can go to the mikvah is at nighttime, which is at the start of the 8th day after the 7 days are over, because again in Judaism, days start at the nighttime. So the answer is that we're talking about even an Anida Daraisa who perhaps didn't get to the mikvah on the night immediately following the conclusion of her 7 days of Nidos, but she didn't get to the mikvah at that time. She wants to go to the mikvah at a future date, a couple days later perhaps. She still has to go at nighttime. She's not allowed to go during the day. Why? And there's another thing thrown into this, which is Avraham Chinuch is about to tell you, which is Vafal Pish Tvilas Azova Afilu Bayom Midin Torah. The other thing thrown into this is that nowadays there's really no reason, I'll be strict basic halacha, for a woman to go to the mikvah at nighttime, because again, just to review, so a woman is now, we're not sure whether she's a nida or a zava, so she has to count 7 clean days. But the 7 clean days are way past the conclusion of her 7 days of nidos if she's a nida d'oraisa. And if she's a zava, in fact, then she's allowed to go to the mikvah during the day on the 7th day of the 7 clean days. Right? Because it says, v'safra la shiva yamim v'achar titar, that she's count 7 days, then she could become ritually pure. She could become tahor, meaning that after she completed the counting of the 7 day, of the 7th clean day, b'dika, whatever, in the morning, then she's considered to have counted that day. It's now a clean day, and therefore she can go to the mikvah and become tahor immediately. So nowadays all women are zava. So it's way past the 7 days of nida. And if she's a zava, then she's allowed to go to the mikvah during the day. So why should she have to go to the mikvah at night even nowadays? Afal pichein, amru chachamim. The sages told us shetvilas kulan balayla mishum srach bita. Even so, a woman is not allowed to go to the mikvah during the daytime, even if she's a real zava. Even if she knows for sure she's a zava de'araisa. So she's not allowed to go to the mikvah until nighttime. It's interesting that the Gemara says that really, midaraisa, a woman who's a zava, she could go to the mikvah on during the day of the 7th clean day. But asru chachamim la'asos kein, the chachamim forbade us from doing this, shema tavo lidei safek, lest she come to have some issue. What's the issue? Pipash, this is what the Gemara means, is that if she goes to the mikvah during the day on the 7th day, she and her husband are going to say, woohoo, we're early, we did the mikvah as soon as possible. They're going to chap around, they're going to have relations right away in the middle of the day of the 7th clean day. And then, whoops, later on during that day, she's going to see blood. So that is a problem. Why? Because now the whole day, even though she's allowed to go to the mikvah earlier on that day, the whole day still has to be a clean day. If she saw blood during the day of the 7th clean day, that undoes the whole 7 clean days. So it means that retroactively, that the woman and her husband are now going to, not going to be chayav kares because it was b'shogeg, but they're still going to be have done a sin retroactively. Yeah.
But what if this emission happened, say, a couple hours later? After it was already night, it was already nighttime, and she'd gone to the mikvah, and then
if it's nighttime,
yeah.
If she's a real zava, she goes to the mikvah during the day on the 7th clean day.
What I'm saying is, supposing that in fact, okay, so you say the 7th, that they don't want her to go to the mikvah on the 7th day during the day,
right?
And then have relations on that day, and then then sometime that afternoon,
right,
find there's blood.
Right.
Supposing she'd done the proper thing,
right,
and maybe a matter of a few hours, let's say,
yeah,
going after dark,
yeah,
have relations after dark, and then found the same thing. It's a matter of a few hours later.
No, but that doesn't undo the whole 7 clean days retroactively. That's a new sighting of blood.
But that
just from the time she sees the blood, she now becomes a nida again.
Okay, I know that, right? So, but undoing, I mean,
the only
make it so much worse. I don't understand what's the
because. a sighting of blood on the afternoon, yeah, or any time, yeah, during the day on the seventh clean day retroactively undoes the whole seven clean days, because that unit of 7 days needs to be totally clean.
7 days anyway, though, doesn't she?
At this point, she would have to start a new 7 days, yeah.
All right, so the undoing...
But if she gets to the night, even if she sees blood later that night, if she makes it to the night following the, yeah, seventh clean day, so she's completed her seven clean days. Now, this sighting of blood now is new. That creates a new status of Nida. That has nothing to do with her... With
new
her
status,
seven clean days.
Status.
No, it
she
doesn't...
Still has, she still has, and Bashoge, she and her husband...
No, absolutely not, because it doesn't undo the seven clean days. Once she completes the seven clean days,
yeah,
so a new site, it's the same as if she completed her seven clean days, then 3 weeks later, she got her period. That doesn't retroactively undo,
okay,
the seven clean,
so,
days.
In terms of...
I mean, it's their status that's the problem, not the 7 days you would have to wait, in fact.
What do you mean?
I think what he's trying to say is that what you're trying to
say?
What
I'm trying to say is, okay, that obviously it is a very bad thing, even Bashoge, okay, that's how relate, you know,
right,
okay.
But once she completes the day, so she's fine.
Okay, so in other words, okay, no, sorry, I misunderstood. So in other words, the thing is that presuming that she finds the blood afterwards,
right,
after the BF, okay,
right,
then, okay, then, and then, it is no reflection on, you have assumed that at the time of the relations, she was fine, if it was, you know.
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
however,
like.
Okay,
yeah.
However, you're saying, though, if, in fact, that it was during the afternoon of the seventh day.
Right, that retroactively undoes.
Then means then, in fact, that she was Anita at
she
the time.
She was a Zava, yeah, whatever.
She,
yeah.
Was, right, whatever was, right. She, that her status was, in fact, that of Anita at the
at
time.
During the time, exactly.
Okay, okay, 100%. Okay, okay.
Yes, correct. 100%.
Okay.
So the reason... so the Chachamim, so the Gemara says, so that's a simple understanding. She's not allowed to even go to the mikvah during the day of the seventh. Of the seventh clean day, because she might see blood later in the day,
okay,
and that retroactively undoes her status. But there is another understanding that's found in the Rishonim, is that what it means is, Tosfos doesn't like this, he quotes this opinion also, he completely rejects it. He said, the other interpretation is that she's allowed to go to the mikvah, but she's not allowed to have relations until the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Meaning that, so the Tosfos asks, what does that mean, Shema Tavu Lidei Safik? If she waits to have relations, so then, if she's allowed to go to the mikvah, but the prohibition, the chachamim only prohibit her to have relations, that's not shema tov lidei sofek, that she might have some doubt as to her status before. She knew what her status was by the time the end of the day came. So the Tosfos says that shita really doesn't make too much sense. And furthermore, many point out that the pashtus is that the prohibition to have relations during the day of the, this is the Beis Yosef discusses it, but it could be very well be that the prohibition to have relations on the seventh day of the seven clean days, even if she went to the mikveh before, is din d'oraisa, because the Torah is concerned that maybe, you know, it could very well be that she could see blood on this day and retroactively undo it. Others say no, that according to the Torah, she went for seven clean days totally clean, so she's not, she doesn't have to be concerned on the seventh day that she's gonna see blood. And in Midoraisa, she and her husband would be allowed to have relations during the day on the seventh clean day, even after she went to the mikvah. And if she did see blood in the afternoon, it would be some sort of freak thing. It would be onus that they would, you know, that there would be no responsibility for that. So that's different approaches to that. But nevertheless, certainly, at least the Rabbanan, she's not allowed to have relations, and certainly not allowed to go to the mikvah even during the day on the seventh clean day. Why? So all women, even if they are past the time that they could go to the mikvah on a d'oraisa level, then they are still not allowed to go until it's nighttime, because the woman's daughter might see, oh, you know, they had smaller houses, I guess. People knew more people's business in the olden days. The daughter's going to say, oh, mommy's going to the mikvah during the day. You know, she might be a Nida, she might be a Zava. You know, I'm sure she's very frum, so she's going to do what she's supposed to do. So maybe she's a Nida, and she's going to the mikvah during the day on the seventh day. So you see that even a Nida de'araisa, who's tamei on a de'araisa level for the full extent of the 7 days, is allowed to go to the mikvah during the day on the seventh day, which is not true, that a Nida de'araisa is only allowed to go on the night of the eighth day, whereas on a Zava is allowed to go on the daytime of the seventh day. So to avoid this confusion, as we demonstrated before, these complex things are very complicated, can easily engender confusion. So therefore, Chazal instituted that a woman is only allowed to go to the mikvah at nighttime, lest somebody else pick up on it and think that you're allowed to go during the day in an improper at an improper timing.
When do people post, you know, how many days they are after the last time they've seen blood? I mean,
on Facebook.
Fine.
Yeah. You post on Facebook. I'm just on your status. I'm in day two. I'm in day three.
No, he's joking.
In the olden days, people at a smaller town, you know, so mikvah wasn't, you know, I don't know. It was perhaps more visible when people were doing. You're supposed to hide the time that you're going to the mikvah, but nevertheless, certainly within the family, if the, you know, you can figure things out. You know, people say when they were little kids and they couldn't figure out why on earth, like random nights, like the mother would just, you know, hog the bathroom and take a bath and just leave the house. You know, like, what are my parents fighting? You know, what's going on? Did she just left the house? Is she going shopping at weird times?
You come some with wet hair when it's not raining. You
know? Exactly. So there are ways, there are certainly ways to figure it out. So the Gemara says in Maseches Nida, the discussion that we were talking about. Uvimakom dochak. So what happens if there's an emergency type of situation? Kegon shedalsos medina nin alos balayla. Let's say you're not living in a Jewish city, you're living in a goyish city. Let's say you have so you have a walled city, and the people who are watching the city close the doors of the wall at nighttime. And let's say the mikvah is located outside the city walls. So if a woman goes to the mikvah, you know, leaves her house in the late afternoon, and she goes to the mikvah at nighttime, and she tries to come back to the city, let me in, let me in. She's going to get locked out of the city, so she has no choice but to go during the daytime. And that's such a situation, then you're allowed to go to the mikvah during the daytime, so you don't get locked out of the city. The Gemara gives other examples of Amoraim who permitted going to the mikvah during the day, and there are locations based on the fact that there were wild animals roaming around at night, or there were thieves who were roaming around at night. I remember someone told me, one of my teachers in high school, who lived in Baltimore, said that before they built the new Baltimore mikveh in the current Jewish neighborhood, the mikveh was located in an area where the Jewish community used to be, and it was not a safe neighborhood. So I don't think they allowed women to go during the day, but they had serious security. They had people, you know, around the perimeter of the mikveh to make sure that nothing would happen. Umikol makom asura l'shamesh ad halayla, and nevertheless, then she's not allowed to have relations until the nighttime. Shematira v'tistor kol minyana v'nimtza shebaal hatmeya. So therefore, if she sees blood later on the day on the seventh day, then she's going to undo her all 7 days, and retroactively they'll be considered to have sinned. Lefi shetarasa talakaso b'yamim utvila. That the woman is completely anida until she goes to the mikvah after the correct number of days have passed, and neither one is sufficient without the other. So the Sefer HaChinuch here is extremely interesting because he sounds like when on all these emergency situations that a woman is allowed to go to the mikvah during the day, it's talking about the day of the seventh day, on the seventh day of the seven clean days. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is not the approach of most Rishonim. According to most Rishonim, what it's talking about is a woman is allowed to go in an emergency situation to the mikvah on the eighth day.
You're always allowed to go on the eighth day.
Not during the daytime. Emergency? Really, in a normal situation, even if a woman, for some reason, delayed her going to the mikvah, then she still has to go at nighttime, even if it's past her correct time to go to the mikvah. Mm-hmm. So she's not. But this is a minority view of the Rishonim. Based on the Baal Hamor also says this, that he says that since nowadays all women are nidos, I mean, are considered to be zavos. So there's no question of confusion whatsoever. A woman is always allowed to go to the mikvah, technically, on the day of the seventh day, and the tevila works. Therefore, there's no reason of sarach bita anymore nowadays. It's an extremely minority view in the Rishonim, which is even more permissive than Sefer HaChinuch. But you have a large variety of opinions in the Rishonim. But the basic view that's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch and is the opinion of most Rishonim is that it's only during the eighth day or later that a woman in an emergency situation is in fact allowed to go to the mikvah, and there a woman is never allowed to go to the mikvah during the day of the seventh day of the seven clean days because it's concerned that they might have relations and she might undo her whole counting and whatever. One situation where it's brought that a woman is allowed to go to the mikvah on the seventh day is a new bride. if a woman is getting married, then she's not even married yet. So there's no there's no chance that she's going to have relations before the proper time, before the night time. So when they're going to go to their hotel or whatever after the wedding, so there's such a situation. According to the vast majority of poskim against the shach is extremely machmer on going to the mikvah on the seventh day. He says you shouldn't go to the mikvah on the seventh day at all, basically. And whereas even the opinions, the majority opinion that the woman is really never allowed to go to the mikvah on the seventh day of the seven clean days, nevertheless, if a woman did it, then b'di'evad the tefillah works. The Shach said we should really be concerned for the shittas that the Chachamim decreed that the tefillah doesn't even work, and she should go to the mikvah again at night, which again is the minority opinion.
But what does that mean it doesn't work? And then what?
On a derabanan level, that the immersion doesn't work, so she remains in the status of nida on a derabanan level. So the... right, so there are certain situations where the Achronim say... Taking into account of what's the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, that Rabbeinu Tam says that, that we don't have to be so machmir, and it doesn't because the whole gezeira is that they shouldn't have relations until really the nighttime. That she shouldn't even go to the mikvah is just sort of ancillary, just to make 100% sure that they won't have relations till the proper time. So Rabbeinu Tam says that it's okay if she goes to the mikvah late in the day and then doesn't come home until nighttime. So there's no chance of them having relations. So it's a difference of opinion amongst the later commentators, later poskim. Well, Rabbeinu Tam meant, did he mean it's even okay to go to the mikvah late in the day on the seventh day of the seven clean days, or only on the eighth day, on a later day, when you have to go to the mikvah during are you still allowed to go during the daytime? So that's not exactly clear. But in certain very emergency situations, there will be times that a rabbi will permit a woman to go to the mikvah during the day and the seventh on the daytime of the seventh on the seventh clean day, and not even to come home until the nighttime, based on the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. There are very big kulas that some poskim, contemporary poskim, give nowadays, which is that if it's let's say a Friday afternoon. And there's no mikvah, and they live very far from the mikvah, so she can't go Friday night. So the seventh clean day will be a Friday, and so she can go Friday afternoon, and then she comes, her husband leaves for shul before she comes home. No. It's a huge, very big gula, because the pashas in the Rishonim is that really that she's not allowed to come home at all before nighttime. The Chasam Sofer says that maybe she could go to a friend's house, even that's not so pasha, maybe she should just take all her...
Why does the friend have to know?
She doesn't have to know anything. Can I come visit?
Yeah.
You don't have to tell her friend why she's going to
visit.
You have
to say Baltimore before, then...
Right.
If it were Friday night, it's basically not possible to go.
Right, unless they had smaller mikvahs just for Friday night use. That's a good... Right, if we're into Friday night, it's real.
In that case, then with that ultimately... Otherwise, obviously, it could be put off until Saturday night.
Right.
But is this...
But how would she bench lift? Where would she bench lift?
Yeah.
Her friends. So that would...
Her husband would have to do it for her.
Ah, right. And then the kids are going to ask, what's happening, baby?
Well, they could. They could be entertained.
Tali's friends come over all the time with little kids on Friday.
Convenient.
No, when the husbands are far off to shul, they get married.
So we should try to avoid putting it off for an extra day, if possible.
Well, really,
about Baltimore, where basically she cannot, get there and back.
But then she would have to go. Really, she would have to go on the 8th.
So
I think different rabbis have different policies of how lenient they're going to be on this, but in the, shall I say, the modern Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, whatever you want to call it, community in America, it's become very quick to be makel on this, that, we live far from the mikvah, so we can go on the seventh day, and I just won't come home until nighttime, or my husband will go to shul. It's very not so pasha. Many, according to many Rishonim, I mean, really, you're never allowed to do this. Very, very, very not so pasha to go to mikvah on the seventh day. Where certain the heter will be given in very emergency situations, like let's say you can't get to the mikvah and you won't be able to go for a very extended period afterwards. So then it'll be pretty common for someone to be makel on this. I remember, I think Rabbi Schwartz told me of a case. Not that I don't think he was asked the question, but I heard of. That a couple was already hired to go to a Pesach hotel, I think, some Sukkot hotel, whatever it was, and her mikvah night was supposed to be the first night of a 3-day yontif, and she wouldn't be able to go to the mikvah for another 3 nights if she weren't allowed to go during the day. So maybe I believe, that he said that she should go to the mikveh during the day of Erev Yontif, and they should go in separate cars to the hotel and just not go into the hotel together until it was already nighttime. Again, there are Rishonim who are makel completely, but most Rishonim, like I said, are really machner completely on this shayla, that a woman should never go to the mikveh on the daytime of day seven. So we have to be very, very hesitant before and be makel on this. Unless another situation would be that if a couple is having difficulty conceiving and they wouldn't be able to get to the mikveh for another couple of days, so then we would generally allow her to go to the mikveh even during the daytime of the seventh clean day.
There's a practical thing of the mikveh being open during the day.
Well, you have different mikvos that are more flexible. If you go to the, probably to the Upper West Side, and say, excuse me, you know, my rabbi says I'm allowed to go today, will you please open for me? I'll pay extra fee, whatever, then they'll probably open for you. If you call mikvah, they'll probably say, go jump in a lake. We're open.
Okay.
Good. That works.
Lake is good.
I don't know. I don't know the exact policies of different mikvahs. I different things. You have to discuss it with the appropriate people, the mikvah lady, the rabbi, etc.
Is there still one on the Lower East Side?
Yes. There is. Certainly, yeah.
What is the status of the ocean or lake insofar as tefillah is concerned?
The ocean is okay. I have to take care for a couple of reasons. One is that if it's a beach, so people might see you. We're generally discouraged immersing in a public place because the woman is going to be very embarrassed and she's going to try to go as quickly as possible and she might not, you know, do the immersion properly. And the other thing is that when it doesn't have a clean floor, so there could be, you could get sand in your toes.
What if there is no mikveh?
So if you take the appropriate precautions, you try to go at a time where it's not, the beach is not populated, there's not going to be people seeing you.
And there's no lifeguard.
And you make sure, well, the husband would have to go, obviously. Okay. Or another woman shouldn't go alone, in general.
No, I meant safety-wise, and sometimes they don't want you to be on the beach if there's no lifeguard.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, this is involving sneaking around. Yeah, you know what I mean? So, okay, you have to maybe have a private beach.
In the lake, it depends upon the kind of lake.
That's right.
You have geologists figure out exactly what the...
So a lake could be a problem. A lake could be a problem because if it's a man-made, or any type of lake, really, and it's mostly, the water in the lake is mostly rainwater and not water that comes from flowing springs and rivers, you know, way up in the source of the wherever the river is, then it could be a problem.
You said mostly. Does that mean
it goes by rove?
Percentage
yeah.
of water is. I mean, how are you going to
do that? You have to judge. If, let's say, there's a river or a lake or something that during the non-rainy season is very low, and then during the rainy season it swells up with rainwater, then it could be a problem because we know that if water comes from a spring, then it could serve as a mikveh, really, a mayan, it's called. Mm. Even if the water is flowing, but in a mikveh, which is comprised of rainwater or non-spring water, then the water has to be completely still. So basically, in general, water in a lake is not completely still. So therefore, you have to be very sure that it comes from a natural spring as opposed to rainwater. Mm-hmm. It depends. You have to... Most rivers...
Why do I ask? Because there was a young man who's a rabbi in Santo Domingo, and he came to New York, among other reasons, to collect money so that he could build a mikveh, because right now all the women have to go in the, I don't know if he said lake or the ocean.
So hopefully he checked out the whatever it was, and he decided it was okay. Yeah, but then you have to make sure also to rinse, you know, we said before that it's a common misconception that when a woman immerses herself in the mikveh, anyone, any person, or any kli, whatever, gets immersed in the mikveh, that it has to be raised above the floor of the mikveh, which is not true. That has to.
What does that mean?
It means you're allowed to stand on the floor of the mikveh and just dunk your head under, and you don't have to raise your feet from the floor of the mikveh when you're immersing. So,
Why would you have to raise your feet? I mean,
because you have to be totally ensconced in the water at one time.
You can't get into the water unless your feet get wet.
Right, that's exactly the point.
So,
the point is, you might think that since your foot is snugly pressed against the mikveh floor, so that prevents water from getting in. Therefore, the bottom of your foot is not in contact with water.
On the way down, you go.
Right, but you have to be all in at one time. So maybe, but that's not true. That's what I'm saying. That's exactly false. Exactly false. Your foot is, even though your foot has gotten wet before it touches the floor of the mikveh, which is a smooth tile. Therefore, there's going to be a tiny layer of molecules of water that come into contact with the mikveh water, and therefore it's called the principle of mayim makdimim, that the water comes first, and therefore it can, even if you touch something else, so you still consider it to be in contact with the water.
You don't have to basically roll yourself up into a ball and float entirely.
Right, you don't have to float entirely in the water with your head underneath. You're allowed to stand on the floor of the mikveh and just dunk your head underneath. So you're totally under the water, under the surface of the water. Mm-hmm. So, in such as if there's a smooth floor of the mikveh, but if it's a very sandy and it's your foot is going to get dirty, so this principle doesn't necessarily apply. Then you might have to jump up and rinse your foot in the water at the same time as you're dunking your head underneath. That's anyway. But it can be done if you go on vacation and there's no mikvah. If you have access to the ocean, that's better. Ocean's for sure okay. Mm-hmm. Ocean is for sure a kosher mikvah. Mm-hmm. But lakes and rivers have to be investigated. Okay, v'noheg iser zeh b'chol makom u'v'chol zman. That this prohibition is in all places and all times. V'over aleha v'shachav es hanida b'mezid. If you had relations with hanida on purpose, mikevan shehera b'chayev karis. Even if you don't have complete penetration, but just the glands goes inside the woman's body, then that is chayev karis. That's considered to be the equivalent of full relations in halacha. If you do it by accident, in other words, you don't know that the woman that there is such a prohibition as nida, or you don't know that the woman is a nida at the time, then you have to bring a chatas. And of course, there's a difference between what's called shogig and onus. That shogig means you did something wrong. But if you're onus, then you didn't do anything wrong. You don't have to bring a chatas. So, for example, if a woman is not expecting her period at all at the time, some people say that even so, you're only considered honest if she made a bedikah before and it was clean, whatever it is. But in case if there's no reason at all for you to expect that the woman is about to have her period, then you even if she ends up having her period and starting to bleed in the time middle of the time that you were having relations and you didn't realize, then you would not have to bring a chatas at all because you didn't do anything wrong. Shogi means you should have known better. You did something wrong, therefore you have to bring a chatas. If she knows she became Tommy in the middle, then you would have to disengage in a very particular way, which basically we'll not go into right now. Then Hanida Eino Nikra Mamzer Elav Lad Pogum. Hopefully, it won't happen to anyone ever, so we won't need to know exactly how to do that. Uven Hanida Eino Nikra Mamzer Elav Lad Pogum. So if a child was conceived while a woman was in the status of Nida, so you might think that he would be a mamzer. He would be a halachic bastard and would not allowed to marry into the Jewish people because we have a general principle that someone who was born from a union that was subject to a prohibition of kares is a mamzer. Mm-hmm. If someone is born from a union that's only subject to a lav, a plain negative commandment, like for example, if a couple gets divorced and the woman marries someone else and then the second husband dies or they get divorced, then she's not allowed to go back to the first husband. So in such a situation, that's not an iser karis, it's only a lav. So if the original husband remarried his wife who had been married to someone else in the interim, then that's only a lav, not allowed to do it. But if they did it and they had a child, then that child would not be a mamzer at all. But karis, nidas iser karis, just like a man and a married woman, or a man and a close relative, was an iser karis, and the child is a mamzer. So why isn't a nida an iser karis? The question is whether it's really considered to have the status of an erva in the same way. However, it's not exactly 100% clear, but the child of a woman who's a nida is not a mamzer, is allowed to marry a regular Jew, but with a caveat. It's considered to be vlad pogum, that there's something a little wrong with him. So maybe it's not the best idea to marry someone who was conceived from a union of Anida.
What do you want him to do?
Parents don't use the mikvah.
Wander around being single?
What?
Be single?
No.
They marry other people in their situation.
Right, so Reb Moshe Feinstein, living in an era where we're already dealing with the Baal Shua movement, where we have tons and tons of perfectly observant, fine Jews who were presumably conceived of unions that did not observe Hilchos Nida. So Moshe Weinstein writes that Vlad Pogum is just it's a recommendation. It means that you just have to be on the lookout that someone who's not born from a union of Kedusha is more prone, perhaps, to improper character traits. But if you look, if you date the person, and you see that this person is a fine, perfectly good, upstanding Jewish citizen, perfectly observant, good midos, or whatever, then there's no reason whatsoever to refrain from marrying this person, even though, presumably, the person was conceived from such a union. He also writes something...
Not
some,
to refrain
what?
From.
You don't.
You should not refrain.
Basically, the psak that's given nowadays by... That's generally accepted is that if you see that, that makes perfect sense. That's exactly what it's talking about. It's something a little wrong with him, but if you see that he's overcome or she has overcome the
handicap,
whatever it is, the handicap of being conceived of a non-need observing union, then it's no problem whatsoever to marry this person. Reb Moshe Feinstein also writes a humorous line, where he says, well, it could be also that, you know, you have to see when the person was born, because if you count with the person's birthday and you subtract 9 months, and, you know, it was the summertime, so maybe his mother was going to the ocean, and she was wearing a loose-fitting bathing suit, and, you know, at some point during the ocean, she had completely immersed herself under the surface of the ocean, and she really wasn't need at all, and that's the reason that this person displays such good character traits. So it's a cute way of basically telling this person, you know, you really shouldn't be concerned if it's a fine match. There are families where they are makbid on this. There are families where they investigate whether the mother, the grandmother kept the
tosnida. The that they're looking for. From, that they come from a family. What do you know about the family? I mean, just one of the aspects of that.
And the
they're assumed that's like, an aspect.
Okay.
I've heard some of a Baal Tshuva, you know, in a certain Hasidic group who was very bitter because that this idea is very much current, that there's a mum.
Well, they take it mystically, that there's something wrong with the kedusha of this person. Yeah.
And that, you know, that there's a stratification between those who are always from and those, you know, and that...
Well, I assume after a few generations, there's only so much you can investigate. Mm-hmm. So, but again, if it's a recent Baal Tshuva phenomenon, is relatively recent. But
just not to, quote, defend this whole thing, but one of the things one might think about is that people, especially when people get married pretty young, people are concerned about who their machatanim are going to be, who their grandchild's other grandparents are going to be.
Yes,
so
yes.
It's not as totally off the wall as people like myself.
But that has nothing to do with Nida per se. That's just because they want the from influence on the grandchildren.
I know.
According to that, then, let's say the parents of your potential machatanim used to not be from, and then they became Baalei Tshuva, and the person was conceived... The potential Chasan Kala was conceived before the parents became from, then according to that approach, then there's no problem because there's still going to be a nice from influence on the grandchildren.
But the other way around, let's say that they were, you know, the mother was, you know, Shomer, Tzav Shpach at the time that the kid was conceived, but then went off the derech afterwards.
But basically, in most communities, even yeshivish, even whatever, if the person is... Again, people have different akpadas, different ideas in their heads about what they want for their the children-in-law or spouses or whatever, or mechutanim, but basically, halakhically, we assume that if the person has good character traits and is a very fine person, then there's no problem. Uvalav de lo yavo mamzer nevar bezras Hashem beseder kiteitze. That when we get to kiteitze, we're going to discuss all the details of what, in fact, does constitute a mamzer, which is not a benid at all. I remember I heard it. Oh, yeah.
Somebody once commented that, you know, in Israel, that even the chilonim, you know, the insult is a mamzer ben nida.
Oh yeah.
Says, oh, you see, even you know, they even curse each other in halachic terms.
Yeah. Interesting.
You were going to say.
Well, it also depends. Svardim Ashkenazim, secular Ashkenazi women, by and large, do not observe Hilchos Nida, whereas Svardi women, even if they're marginally traditional, they generally do.
Wow, that's pretty.
I don't know with all the details in the Shulchan Aruch, I'm not sure, but.
But the concept is there.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
No, I mean, practically speaking, how are you going to find out about what their grandmother said?
I mean, you have to look at the whole package. If a woman was kept strictly Shabbos and Kashrus, which is more easily observable, then so presumably she kept Taras HaMishpacha as well.
Though, my impression is...
It depends how modern.
No, but also, that in fact, that the, you know, that Orthodox people, say, in the 50s and 60s, whatever it might be,
right.
You know, or earlier on,
right.
This was an area in American Jewish
right.
life, certainly, where...
Right. Even if you went to an Orthodox shul and you kept kosher at home and
is,
you kept Shabbos, basically, so a lot of women did it. Right.
Yeah.
But you have to know. You have to know how from they were. If they,
and who is going to have the chutzpah to ask their mother what her mother did?
Well, you have some idea. I mean, whatever.
Maybe not.
You have some idea. Yeah. Fine.
On
yeah. We'll begin this a little bit. I know everyone was very excited for this mitzvah, so I don't want to disappoint. We'll at least begin it today, which is mitzvah Reish Ches 208, Shelo Nitein Mizareinu LaMolech, that we're not allowed to give our progeny to Molech. Who's Molech? Okay, we'll find out. Really?
What?
What?
Shaloni tain ktsas mi banenu lahaaviram lifnei avodazara. We shouldn't take some of our children and pass them before an avodazara, some idolatrous form of worship. Shahayu osin bnei adam bizman matan Torah, that it was common at the times of the giving of the Torah. Shayashmo Molech, and his name was Molech. As we're going to see, there's actually a difference of opinion that's actually brought in the Gemara, and a difference of opinion of the Rishonim, how to paskin, whether Molech was in fact an Avodah Zarah at all. According to some opinions, Molech was just some sort of icon that you know, just sat there, and this is something you did in front of it, but was not an act of worship of this icon per se. But the Sefer Chinuch clearly holds like the opinion that it was in fact an Avodah Zarah. And your back, in your insight into the mitzvah, in the back of...
Wait, but what does it say about H, though? The Pasuk talks
about it. Yeah, they passed it in fire in
no,
front of the icon.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. We read it yesterday. It's actually quite ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Just says Molech, yeah.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
You have to, you know, add quite a lot.
Well,
we all
well, the
think of the fire and whatever.
Well, there is another Pasuk that talks about fire.
Yeah, but I mean, but in that particular one, it doesn't.
Seems...
Right. But he said, it brings about in the insights, mm-hmm. I just saw it before this year, which is that, that the Meiri, I think, he quotes the Meiri who says... that for sure it wasn't Avodah Zarah. The issue is only was this an act of worship of the Avodah Zarah, or was it, I think he says, an initiation into the cult of Molech? That this wasn't viewed as an act of worship of the deity of Molech per se, but rather it was just what do they call it? Hazing. That when you join the fraternity, then you have to undergo certain travails before you can be fully accepted as a member of the cult of Molech.
It
yeah?
might not be totally, absolutely Avodah Zarah, but it's pretty close.
Well,
you're getting involved with this stuff.
So wait a second. So
right,
not
yeah.
child sacrifice?
Sacrifice, that's also machlokes that we'll see in the Sefer Chinuch later. Yeah.
Okay.
Shenemar umizaracha lo sitein lahavir la Molech. You shouldn't give some of your children to Molech. Gelomar miksa zaracha. That if you give all your children to Molech, you're not chayav.
Mom,
that's we'll see later.
Oh, that's some.
You have to.
That's some wise guy.
Yeah. Yeah. What?
Trying to outsmart the teacher.
Yeah.
Come on.
So it also says v'nichpala azhara. It says in a different place in the Chumash in Dvarim, lo yimatze becha ma'avir beno vitova ish. There shall not be found amongst you anyone who passes his children through fire. V'chachayu osim. What did they do? Ha'av mosro lakomrim. The father used to give the child to the priests, l'shem shikutzam, and for the sake of the Molech. Ke'en ma'shekosu b'karbanos k'sherim, like we're talking about lahavdil real karbanos in the base of Mikdash, unesana mel ha'kohen, that before the owner, the smicha, places his weight on the sacrifice, so first you give it to the kohen and to initiate it into the kohen's korbanness. Be'efshe she'akmarim osim bo tenufo agosh l'ifnei ha'molech. The Sefer Chinuch says, it doesn't found anywhere in Chazal, this is what they used to do. But maybe they used to do an act like they used to, like they do for Karbanos, that they wave it up and down before Molech. V'achar kach machzirin oso la'av. Then the priest gives it back to the father, mavirin eish gedola lifnei ha'avodah zarah. Then you light a fire before the avodah zarah, either in a pit, according to one opinion in the Gemara, or there was like a wall of bricks that you would do between two fires. The av lokeach beno ma'aviro belahav ha'eish. And the father takes him and passes him through the fire in the pit. So you're not fully chayav for the prohibition of giving your children to Molech until you first have to give the child to the priest, then take it back, and then you pass him back and forth. Now, Rashi says, which I do not believe that the Sefer HaChinuch brings, which is that Rashi says, and it's a commentary on the Chumash, which I'm sure everyone knows from, because this was read just in Parshas Achrei Mos yesterday, that I'm sure everybody in their weekly thorough study of the Parsha with Targum and Rashi and other other selected commentators, I'm sure everyone remembers this comment of Rashi from just last week. And Rashi says that it was in fact the priests and not the father who used to do the thing of passing him through the fire, and not the father wouldn't actually do it himself. So it's very, the other Rishonim say that's very difficult. The father didn't really do anything. Again, maybe according to Rashi, the method of worship is you give it to the priest and the priest does it, but it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like the father is actually doing something in terms of the passing the child through the fire.
It's all bad.
So you can't be chayav, the father can't be liable to the death penalty because he gave it to the priest. Fine. Vedasa Rav Rashi. Zichronim Livracha. So Rashi and Rambam, Zichronim Livracha, Shaloaya Sorfo El Avoda Haisa Lahaviro Levad. So this is what we were wondering about before, that according to Rashi and the Rambam, this did not involve death. That the child did not die based. He just, you know, it's like when you take your finger, you have a candle, and you pass your finger very quickly through the flame of the candle, so you don't feel anything. It doesn't feel hot.
Oh, no.
It feels,
fast enough.
Remember when I was...
People walk on coals, you know, right?
Right. When I was like 6, it was one of my friends showed that to me. I was totally astounded that you could pass your finger through fire and not feel anything. But it's true. You can. Umikevan. Right. You can't leave it there. No.
Here's a good proof text against hazing. Mm-hmm. We should get this out there. We should really get this out there.
So it just passed them through the fire. Mikevan she'aviru kamo shaya darkam la'aviru chayav. That since this was the way that the Molech was either worshipped or honored, then it's still chayav, even though the child remained very alive and well. V'daras Ramban zichron al racha, as I'm sure you again know from your thorough study of the Parsha, because you can't learn Rashi without the Ramban. You have to know the opposing point of view. So the Ramban has a lengthy essay. Sometimes Ramban is usually much longer winded than Rashi, but here he has a very long essay, as he does it a few times in the Torah, about what exactly the prohibition of passing through the fire to Molech was. So it brings a proof, Shayam Aviro Belavach and Ishmasu Yoseis, that he put him in the fire until the child actually died. The Rayosa Beferish Achumash Asa. So he wrote all the proofs in the commentary on the Chumash that he made, literally, that he wrote. And he basically, he just assumes that there is a very, the prophets, Chizkel, and other places later in the Tanakh describe a similar idea that people would be passing their children and slaughtering their children for various deities. And the Ramban assumes that this was the same as the prohibition of Molech that's recorded in the Torah. So therefore the Ramban brings proofs that really what it's talking about is that the child actually died in the course of passing through the fire for Molech. But again, Rashi and the Rambam do not agree with it. So according to the Ramban, also, you would be liable to murder and not just to the prohibition of Molech. So you could be tried on multiple counts for this prohibition. I think we'll stop here for today and we'll continue next time with more Molech.